Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the CASE podcast, Conversations About Software Engineering. It's my great pleasure to have Ole Lensma with me today. Ole is a serial entrepreneur, serial CTO, technologist, founder, and the brain behind tools like Swagger and SoapUI.
Hello, Heinrich, and everyone else. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, wonderful. I thought theme for this topic, a good theme for this conversation would be cloud native testing, since testing has been around for a while, and it feels like we are at a place where a lot of people are, basically trying to figure out ways how to bring testing into the new reality where we are in Kubernetes, in the cloud, and we have CI/CD systems, and also like reproducing good, getting good test environments in that kind of setting is challenging. And maybe we can just cover in the conversation like the beginnings, kind of how you got get started with testing, how like the testing lifecycle works, how the testing pyramid, the classical testing pyramid has its place, and how it kind of blends into more modern testing approaches, including testing in production, canary deployments, load testing, and so on. And your latest occupation is with a company called now I have to do it right, the right way around. It's TestCube, right?
Not yes, test. It is TestCube. Yes, exactly. And something that's very squarely positioned kind of in the domain of testing in cloud native. So I think you've chosen an excellent topic to talk about. I appreciate that. But obviously, I think but it's super interesting to see how testing has changed both on the tooling side, but of course on the process side, culture side, over the last 10, 15, 20 years. And how it is, of course, going to continue changing as technology changes and as it changes how we build software.
So let me throw you a few curveballs to get the conversation going. So I interviewed Theo Schlossnagel yesterday, and they came up in the 90s. Era software engineering, the .com bubble, and has a a certain style of programming. But conversations that they had with him were also about testing, and it's really about the economy of testing. And in the conversations that we had, the kind of agreement we came to is that in many cases, testing doesn't actually have a positive return of investment. It's like you need to know the bits that you want to test, like where you have really logic that you are testing. And in some cases, the tests, if you are just testing a getter function or something, there's not really much to test. It's also in many cases, you are just like probing a REST endpoint that is then executing a tiny bit of logic, and then you're basically retesting the HTTP integrations and so on. So I always felt like there is kind of the need for the logic. So if I'm really implementing a data structure, to have strong unit tests around this, and then testing for the system behavior. So really making sure, maybe if you have a database, maybe an extreme setting, not everybody's writing a database, but then stuff like replication, reconfiguring nodes, and those things have to be properly tested with kind of a very, like orchestrating this kind of setups is complex and so on. Those are like relatively difficult things to write. But this kind of philosophy is a little bit in tension with the usual kind of mantras of getting like 98% test coverage and so on. So like, what is your take on this kind of problem domain?
So I'm not a fan of this, 80% or 99% code coverage philosophy myself. I think testing is important, but it shouldn't be done for the sake of testing. I say my recommendations usually when people ask me where do we start is if you identify like critical areas in your code that you feel this we really need to have some real, you know, ensure that this it's a complex logic that we've built, an engine, and you should probably have some unit tests to validate that it works as it should. But then I would usually recommend people to zoom out quite a lot and do like a high level integration test as a safety net, right? To make sure that whatever you deploy in front of your end users has the key use cases in place, right? So you can log in, you can do the basic stuff, right? And I would keep that more as a safety net and make sure that that's where I'd start. And then I would maybe fill in the middle if you as you kind of grow and you learn that, okay, these are areas where in our application, it depends on, of course, how complex the architecture is, where things often go wrong because it's hard to predict kind of ripple effects of changes we make, then that's maybe where you would put targeted API tests or, you know, whatever other kind of tests that might be relevant. But the challenge with testing is the more maintaining tests is expensive. Especially today where systems are not, maybe that's not new for today, but systems evolve quickly. And especially if you're early on in a project, you add new things, you move things around, and you might switch out a library for another, et cetera, et cetera. And you want to have some velocity and freedom to move forward pretty quickly. You want some kind of insurance and safety net in place with a basic test harness kind of to, but I at least at the get-go, you don't want to spend a lot of, I don't know about you, I don't want to spend a lot of time writing and maintaining tests just because sometimes it feels that it ends up slowing you down. But it also, both just from a velocity perspective, but also mentally, it kind of feels like, we don't want to embark building this feature because then we have to rewrite all these tests and kind of... It weighs you down a little bit in your maybe enthusiasm going forward. So I don't know if that makes sense, but I'm definitely not a person, although I've weirdly enough worked with building testing tools for like the last 20 years almost. I'm not like the person that says you have to, you know, test as much as you can. I'm also a big advocate of just manual testing. I think a smart tester can do wonders for identifying, you know, those edge cases that you didn't think of when you automated, and also for, you know, helping you figure out why the test failed. They'll usually kind of try to reproduce and try some different permutations and give you really good insights on how to solve the problem versus just an error log from, you know, Playwright test or something, where then there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. I'm just like thinking about my own experience, like, just building private projects, it's really two different kinds. The one is really like small web project where basically no testing. There it's really manual. Does this stuff work? And sometimes you have two views and you only test one view, and then the other view is broken and you don't really notice, but that's the kind of breakage you just tolerate. Mm. And then there is some like more like CADAs where you are like experimenting with data structures or prototyping certain like objects or classes, and there it's basically test driven. So you would either have a lot of print statements to test the functionality or you just directly assert against them.
I've done test driven development, and it's a very cozy way of building. It's maybe not the most high velocity, but of course what comes out at the end will usually work in line with kind of the tests that you started with. I think another challenge is that requirements change quickly, and tests are usually based on requirements. Once again, depends on kind of the kind of application you're building and the industry you're in, but at least from where I am, requirements change all the time. And then, of course, trying to build tests to keep up with the changing requirements can also be a challenge. But I mean, on what you were saying, it's super interesting, although I hate to admit that I haven't really tried, but AI, there's a lot of talk about using AI for generating tests, right?
Yeah.
Using a prompt to say, create a test for this Webflow application, et cetera, et cetera. I'm somewhat skeptic, but I'm guessing that just like I felt AI is a great way to get started and to scaffold something, right? Maybe the basis for a test harness or a test suite, you could use AI to do that, and then you'll have to fill it out with things that is hard for an AI tool to know at this point. But it does make sense that you should be able to say, hey, write a test that simulates kind of this usage pattern, and then that could then somehow adapt to changes in a way that's maybe a hard-coded test cannot.
Yeah, I mean, at least for unit tests, I found AI to be very helpful, since a lot of the test code is quite repetitive. You're just creating a bunch of objects, you're filling in test data, and just prompting AI with, hey, write three tests for this class, or just giving it rough instructions for test this case. That was usually usable out of the box, which I got. And it also helped me to kind of bootstrap a test suite in some cases where I didn't have anything. And just that's also then a good first step, right? Like adding a test is not so bad, but just like getting the test suite set up, integrating it into the build tool.
Exactly.
Like you're saying,
the bootstrapping. I think that's, you know, add, say I'm in a Maven project, building a Microsoft, and add, you know, rest assured, or add test JUnit or whatever, it'll do all that stuff for you. And you can really focus on maybe just validating the filling out the logic for the test, or just augmenting the logic that it created to maybe cover some more edge cases. So I think that can definitely accelerate and maybe make you more willing to both create tests, but also refactor. I haven't used AI to refactor existing code. I'm sure that could also be helpful. And so I think there's a lot of promise. It's intriguing, but like with everything, a little bit cautious.
Yeah, this is a complete tangent, but I have heard very good response from people, colleagues of mine, who have used AI to rewrite existing microservices.
Oh, wow.
So just like from Clojure to Kotlin, or from Kotlin to Go.
Oh, wow.
They basically just like one class at a time, one function at a time, or one file at a time. But they didn't need to know the source language so well. They could just be experts on the target language. And that was like, they say at least 50% faster, or 100% faster, like double as fast. But I mean, for me, with like a little bit of rusty knowledge in tons of languages, this kind of like just getting the basics right, not looking up the syntax for the for loop, is really helpful.
Yes, exactly, with those things. Yeah. No, I remember I was, for some reason, I wanted to create a Jenkins plugin, you know, a couple of months back, and it was like, I was like, oh, now I have to create, or you know, all these descriptors and XML files and everything, and it was just create a prompt. I want to do a Jenkins plugin that does this, and here you go. And then you just fill out the blanks, and so that was super, super helpful. But that's super interesting. Also, I was just thinking about refactoring just existing code, maybe to use a different pattern, right? A design pattern, or introduce an abstract factory for the instantiation of these objects. I don't know, whatever else. I think that would be. Since there is so much training material, I would expect it to do pretty well on that, and especially now with the new O3 model from OpenAI, which is supposed to be extremely competent when it comes to programming. So, exciting times ahead, I guess.
Yeah, just like two more sentences about it. Yeah. Have you tried using Cursor yet? The code editor?
No, we have people at TestCube using it, and they really like it. I haven't tried it myself. Have you tried it?
I tried it. I love it. I didn't get it the first times I installed it. So I basically, I have to log in, that it's already fishy. And then I couldn't really make sense out of it. But I listened to the podcast episode where the founders were at Lex Friedman's, and that kind of made it click and really explained the concepts. Like, just basically, they want to always guess your next steps. So you're always tabbing, so that would be the ideal flow. But what I tend to do is really prompt-driven engineering. So I have the chat on the side, and I just explain to the AI what I want to do, and then I review a diff, and that's already a good step up, and it's pretty okay with multi-file changes. So you're changing some configs and you need to adjust the make file. Or if you do refactorings, if it touches three files, it's usually okay. For single file refactorings, I think it has been working well for quite some time. But if it kind of touches more, it gets more and more challenging for the AI to kind of make sure it actually works. But I think that the way Cursor is leveraging AI also with multiple agents and putting attention to different parts of the document, leveraging linters behind the scenes to kind of double check results.
Okay.
That's fairly refined. And for me, it has been working extremely well.
Thank you for that. I'll have to give it a try. I think there are a lot of adjacent tasks like writing documentation or, you know, using AI to generate change logs or to generate like, not change logs, but like a more, you know, announcements,
release
notes. Sorry. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And all those kind of things, I think, I would expect it to excel at those kind of things.
And then
just obviously you have to proofread and make sure it didn't, you know, do any stupid mistakes, but the time saved there. I think it's very exciting to see where that will take us. So Cursor, I'll definitely give that a try.
Yeah. Like moving on to adjacent topic here, SOAP UI and Swagger.
yes.
They are like API testing tools. And I think they are kind of probably one of the next things that you do once you have kind of your integration tests or your unit tests in place. So like, what is the story behind them? What were kind of the problems that you saw maybe starting with SOAP UI and what's the use case for them?
Sure. So SOAP UI, I was like an architect in a SOA, SOA project. This was like 2002, 2003. Yeah. So we were building these microservices, you know, defining WSDLs and writing schemas for those APIs, for those SOAP APIs. And there weren't any good testing tools for SOAP APIs, not open source ones at least. So SOAP UI became like a hobby project that I wrote on my spare time to kind of build something to help make it easier for our team to test those APIs and those microservices or services at, in our kind of develop while we were building them. And then we open sourced, put that on SourceForge as it was called, in 2005 or something. And it managed to get like an, announcement on some website and it pretty quickly got like, quite a lot of users because it was just, there wasn't really any competition out there, at least open source. Once again, I think it was people were using like JMeter, for SOAP, which they still do. But it didn't have, none of those tools that were available had like a nice visual graphical interface, to quickly create a SOAP request and, you know, look at the response. So that was kind of the story. And then it just grew from there. We just added more and more features and it didn't really meet any competition. And then we, you know, a couple of years later, also launched a commercial version, and then the kind of whole thing grew, and it was joined the SmartBear team in 2011, which then, you know, continued to evolve SOAP UI. Also, at some point there, Postman started showing, showed up as an easy-to-use REST client.
Yeah.
And they did a fantastic job of, you know, building something very easy to just run, you know, do REST requests or HTTP requests and look at JSON responses, which is how people started building these AJAX applications at the time, right? And I think they were really well positioned to kind of serve that market. And of course, Postman has an amazing journey behind itself and come so much further. So that was kind of SOAP UI. And I think, I mean, it's still out there. People who are still stuck in legacy SOAP architectures, I still don't think there's really good alternative. Most people aren't doing SOAP, I wouldn't recommend it either. I think you're doing either REST or GraphQL, and there are better alternatives for that. Swagger, I can't take the credit for creating Swagger. It was a guy called Tony Tam. He was working at a company called Wernick, and which had an API for looking up words, I think. And he had people consuming that API, and he was constantly changing the API, and people were frustrated that they didn't know the changes he was making. So he said, why don't I create a format to describe what the API does? And that was kind of, Swagger, or it was, that's how I was in the inception of Swagger. And then that kind of grew. And Tony was amazingly good at building an open source community around Swagger. Swagger had very early on a lot of people contributing to it. So there was the Swagger specification, and then there was Swagger Code Gen for generating code from Swagger, which people still use. There was the Swagger UI, which I think most people think of when they see Swagger, and they think of Swagger as a testing tool. And then there's a bunch of other Swagger related tools. And then when Smart Bear acquired the Swagger technology, we built Swagger Hub, and we also donated the Swagger specification to the Open API initiative under the Linux Foundation. So there was a lot of things going on around there.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying this. I have definitely used a lot of the Swagger UI components, and it's always so nice if they have Swagger, can get stuff, understand stuff a lot more easily and move from description to code very fast, which is very nice. But on the developer side, is that kind of driven from Java doc style comments, or is it in XML, which is adjacent to the code? How does the developer interface work?
I think you can generate using the, this was a while ago. You can generate Swagger definitions or Open API definitions using the JAX-RS annotations. I'm guessing there are some specific annotations to Swagger if you want to add more specific metadata. But I think that's the common workflow. And, there's always an academic discussion about code first versus design first. So should you be generating your Swagger definition from code, or should you be writing your Swagger definition and then generate code from that? There's these two schools, I guess, right? So, and I've been on both sides of that discussion, and there's pros and cons with everything, so I definitely get that. A lot of tooling out there is, you have these API hubs, or where you design your API, and then you in using maybe a visual tool design basically the interface, which generates the YAML for your Swagger definition, and then you can use that to do a bunch of other things, generate tests and generate code and generate whatever else. So that's, I think, that's an approach that's advocated maybe more in enterprise scenarios, where we want to have certain policies around naming and how you use parameters and security, et cetera. So there's the whole API design lifecycle thing is something that I was deep into for many years, but kind of left that behind when we started this TestCube venture a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I've never thought about the specific perspectives, either the specification first or the implementation first, essentially. But what really strikes me as very useful is this API definition, API documentation, and API testing as kind of being supported by the same tool. And should we elaborate a little bit on the testing story with Swagger? So can you leverage it to already build API tests and get a baseline coverage going?
Well you can definitely do it to scaffold your initial tests, right? So the definition tells you these are the operations, these are all the parameters, these are the expected responses. And you can do that to kind of generate basic a scaffold for more advanced tests. Obviously, it doesn't tell you, if you put this data in, this is what you're going to get out. It's just a generic description. These things go in, this might come out, but there's no correlation between those. But you can do quite a lot with that. You can also use it for security testing, penetration or fuzzing or that kind of stuff. You know which parameter, the attack surface of an API for better or for worse, right? And so you can use a security testing tool to go through that. But it's super powerful. And then you mentioned coverage. You can also look at, you can look at traffic, right? You could record traffic going between a client and a server, and then look at how much of my API definition is this traffic actually covering. All right. So in a way which could be a helpful way to understand, is my API still being used? Which parts of my API are being used? Actually, the company that where I was originally for SOAP UI, they were a data provider. They sold financial data. So for them, it was super interesting to know which data fields are our customers using or requesting the most. They had an API where you could kind of similar to like what you would do in GraphQL today. You could specify selectors for what data you wanted. So you could do like a coverage and analysis and saying, this is the data that people ask for the most. And that's then that helped guided them in where they would focus on data quality and performance and kind of and integrity for that data set. So you can do quite, to your point, and of course you can generate documentation. And I think we've all seen, you know, documentation, API, REST API documentation online. That's either Swagger UI or another tool that generates from the Swagger definition. So super powerful. But on testing, once again, that contract takes you a long way to get that basic scaffold going.
Fascinating. What kind of, like, I really like this kind of product analytics use cases, or like, yeah, let's call it like this, like, how is the API actually used, and where does optimization make sense, and do we actually have documented all the bits where we see our users focusing on, or is an API actually used?
Is there drift, or do you see like people maybe either making requests to things that aren't in the API or old versions? I mean, often you have multiple versions of an API and you want to make sure, are people still using this or not? But I think the data aspect is really interesting to be able to see that this is what they're looking at. And maybe that's even more interesting with GraphQL, where you have a very granular way of querying specific data. And that might be able to give you an understanding of what data are users interested if you have an API, like an API that's public for users to use.
And is that analytics, or the analysis, is that powered by distributed tracing data, or is that another integration?
No, I don't think so. So the analysis of I don't know if distributed tracing would contain the payloads that would, it depends on what you put in the traces, I guess. Based on, what's the format, HAR kind of files, HTTP archives, or just logs, as we call them, and that you would aggregate. There's a bunch of tools like Wireshark, et cetera, to kind of intercept traffic and look at those. But I think today, going to Kubernetes with service meshes, right, where you have Istio or something like that in the middle of all the network traffic going between, that's actually super interesting. Also from another aspect, which is mocking, which is a big deal in testing, right? Where let's say you have an API which has dependencies on other APIs, both external and internal, you might want to mock out those dependencies to do like a black box test, right? So you can simulate kind of how those external dependencies behave. Or you might, you know, let's say you're running a load test against a service that makes calls to Stripe. You don't want maybe Stripe to be hit by that load test, so you'll put something in the middle to mock out that dependency. And once again, those mocks you can generate using the Swagger definition, because you have the contract, or you can generate it from recorded traffic, which is also something that some tools do. And then you could use a tool like Istio to inject yourself into the infrastructure without having to modify the actual service that's being tested, which I think is super compelling. That was always a challenge with mocking, is to that you'd have to basically somehow, you know, inject the mock instead of the actual service, and that you could have a config file with the endpoints and you'd change that, but that's somewhat clunky. And now with the possibilities that you have in Kubernetes, I think that's actually very compelling. It's still, I mean, it's not something, it's still kind of something that you need to, you know, make sure you have all the ducks aligned, but it's definitely doable.
Yeah, maybe this brings us to our core topic here, cloud native testing. We are in the middle of Kubernetes and Istio now. And the first observation is here, this environment looks very different from my like test bench, right? I have this analogy of like fixtures and woodworking. Like I like my code or my application to be like tightly controlled, really boxed in. I can take snapshots. I can like make it work, but it's a local environment. It's like very small, ideally, and if I make it larger, it kind of gets complicated. And I think the use case with Istio and also a lot of things that TestCube is doing is really it's deployed to a Kubernetes cluster. It's it's already operating in its natural habitat where it will be, and we are like validating that it works or like how it's behaving under certain workloads. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a like very interesting shift that for me could be a part of this new cloud native testing, mm-hmm. that we are not so much relying on a workbench, but we are relying on a production like environment where mm-hmm. we are deploying tool and kind of need different tools in order to like understand the behavior, probe the behavior, isolate the workload, and then, I mean, do it in different environments. Like sometimes you have a staging environment, sometimes you don't have the luxury of having it. So you are actually always deploying in the prod in the same cluster if you are not local. And but you can still isolate traffic, you can do experiments and so on. So can you just talk about this topic a little bit? So how do you see this kind of testing environments? What would a good, like, can you see the end game here? So if you think about this, so if you are talking in 10 years again and we kind of solved cloud native testing and before the AI kind of took over,
like, we solved that and then we moved on.
exactly. So
to greener pastures.
How would that kind of end game look like?
I know. I think what's interesting is, I mean, what is cloud native testing? I guess some people will ask, and how is it different from non-cloud native testing? I think the shift we've seen is over the last years with Kubernetes, maybe primarily as the driver, but other things, just cloud in general, is kind of how people build and deploy applications. And then how does testing fit into that? And I think for a long time, it's been, traditionally, you do tests as part of your CI/CD pipeline, right? But I think that's something that as people build more and more CI/CD pipelines, they're maybe using GitOps. They have the granularity of the architecture becomes smaller. So they have a lot of different things going on at the same time. Putting your tests in your CI/CD becomes fragmented. And it doesn't always, play well with kind of that nature of a cloud native application. So where you'd have, originally you'd have like Jenkins, you build your application, test your application, deploys your application, you're good to go. Right now you have two or three CI/CD tools that build a bunch of different components, independently of each other. They're all deployed to a cluster or namespace. And then how do you test those in? You can test them. You have your unit tests, right? If you're as part of the build, but then how do you do integration tests efficiently? Do you do them when things are deployed to the cluster, or do you do them, at certain times, or how do you trigger that? Maybe using something like Captain or Cargo or something to promote builds between environments. And do you start thinking about quality gates and do you inject testing there? So I'm not coming with answers here. I'm just saying, maybe describing kind of what is cloud native testing, what are the complexities around it? And I think we just have to think a little bit differently maybe about how to test and not, and I think people are doing that. So I'm definitely seeing that people are adapting and trying to find out how do we still maintain efficient tests without slowing down all these pipelines making sure that, like going back to where we started originally, that we have these safety nets in place when we put things into production to make sure that the basic user flows are still all fulfilled and that, everything works as it should. So I don't know what the end game is. I think I was just talking to someone yesterday, is that Kubernetes itself is still evolving so quickly, and how we build applications, and now especially with AI coming, is changing a lot. So it's hard to see an end game in that point, just because it's so much in flux, for better or for worse. I mean, we love learning new things and doing new things. But I think I think maybe the recommendation would at least be just be mindful and aware of how we do things changes, and that testing needs to change. And then the strategy that's best for you, obviously, as always, it depends. The engineer's answer, but I don't know. Does that kind of make sense in corresponding to your question? Or
it absolutely does make sense. But I want to just play with this a little bit more, and kind of because this mocking idea, right? To put your application and your process into this kind of environment, where you're also maybe leveraging data you collected in production to spin up the mock, or you are leveraging the load balancer or proxies you have on the egress to kind of mess with your stuff or make sure that the service is just talking to the dependencies that it should be talking to and all this kind of thing. So the sandboxes and also like the eBPF and this kind of technologies, which are getting tighter and tighter integrated into those environments, they kind of give us capabilities to detect a lot of things and do a lot of kind of magic behind the scenes. Yeah, I'm just thinking about like, I have my unit tested application, which has some subtle and not so subtle bugs, and it now goes to staging. And like, what are the bits which we already understand, and how would we kind of identify certain failure nodes modes?
It's like a playground for people who love technology. There's so much, like you said, eBPF, and I'm thinking OpenTelemetry, and there's so much fun things going on. But sorry, that was a little bit of a segue. But I think what we're seeing today is there are a lot of there's tooling out there to help you kind of provision like ephemeral environments, right? For and I think many people just use Argo if they're doing a GitOps approach, but there are other tools to help you do that and to kind of set you up with a often the namespace that's ephemeral, where you deploy the application that you want to test, and then you mock out maybe the services that the application depends on, but that aren't part of the test, and you also maybe generate mock data that you can kind of reuse, so you have a reliable fixture for your tests if they are kind of data driven or if they depend on certain data. And so you'd have some tool that spins that up, and then you'd have another tool that runs the tests, and that's, you know, TestCube or just your CI/CD pipeline, and then tearing that down. And that's kind of an approach we see people kind of build, everyone, or not everyone, a lot of people striving to build that kind of workflow. I think there's no, and I think maybe like what I was saying earlier, there's Kubernetes itself and the ecosystem around it is evolving so quickly. So how to do that? If you set this up 2 years ago or a year ago, you're probably today feeling, oh, if we would have done this today, we would have done it much differently, because now there's this cool thing and that cool thing. So I think I don't think we have come to a place, this is how you do it at a tactical or plumbing level. At a high level, maybe you'd say, yes, you create the ephemeral namespace. And like I said initially here, it's the high level approach. But then how you actually make all those, get those bits and pieces into place, that's something that I think will change as we still kind of try to figure out what's the best way to deploy and manage applications.
Yeah.
But what's your experience? I mean, you're in the space. What are your thoughts?
Like, I'm exploring this, but I have not come to a like real good opinionated view on how it should be. What I do see a lot is that we like deploy canaries and we try to look at error rates and we try to like understand the differences of the behavior between kind of the new deployment and the old deployment. And then we try to be quick with the switching, or we try to separate the feature rollouts with the feature flag from the deployment of the container. And from the monitoring perspective, this opens up a very interesting angle, since you do expect your deployments to be behavior neutral. So basically the task of testing becomes, does the thing work exactly the same as the old thing? It should, there should be no behavior changes. Or probably also the runtime overhead should be very like similar, no big like CPU utilization or memory consumption changes, and everything else kind of gets a deployment validation flag. So you want to take that back. And then once you're actually rolling out the feature, you are expecting a behavior change, but it's rollbackable, like super quick. You can kind of control that aspect of it a lot better. So those are kind of avenues that I'm exploring and I'm thinking about. I see like people trying this out, but it's a lot missing the the probing and okay, let's just validate that the basics are working. And maybe you have endpoints but don't get a lot of traffic. So what do you do then? Do you let that kind of test run for a week and then hope somebody triggers it? And then what do you do with that kind of single request which found a failure? And a lot of the edge cases you will not see for months. And so that approach also clearly has its limitations. But specifically with complicated environments where functionality and user functionality is maybe provided by a dozen applications which are like working together with each other's. I think that kind of approach, moving closer to production, is necessary or at least preferred. And so we kind of have to find ways to make it work. And also a very important aspect of all this is productivity. Because creating a staging environment is extremely expensive. Just mocking everything in a like locally replicable environment is extremely expensive. Just dropping a service into production and expose it under a different like URL and then just playing around with it a little bit, that is super quick and easy.
Super easy.
I ideally want to just give every engineer the ability to do that all the time. So I can have like 3 different versions, or I can have like 10 different versions of the app deployed all the time in production with local access to developers. So they can just do what they need to do. But at the same time, this like it absolutely doesn't fly for all kinds of reasons. But the question is like, can we make that safe? Can we kind of replicate parts of it in an environment which is fast to spin up?
It's super interesting. I think what you were saying, you were mentioning blue-green deployments, and that's something we've seen also, is that people use that as a way to like test in production almost. Like so basically having a specifically of these, what we've seen is Argo rollouts, right? And then using just running tests using tests to validate that the rollout is progressing, or that, you know, validating the functionality of the rollout. You could do it also with the canary, of course, deployment, which is more gradual.
Yeah.
But it's definitely something that we're seeing is where people go straight to production, right? Let's put it out. Let's do canary. Yep. Let's make sure. Let's use our integration tests to validate that the canary is working, is alive, and then use that instead of having a dedicated staging environment, right? So the staging environment is basically the canary that you're rolling out. So that's super interesting. And then another thing we see is, just to cut down once again on the overall test execution burden on your pipeline from a you know, resource cost perspective, but time, is just to do continuous testing in production. It's to say, you know, we run this load test every 4 hours, we run these functional tests one every hour. So it becomes like a monitor, I guess you could say. A functional monitor or non-functional monitor. It could be either security or load or any other kind of test that you might want to run. And of course, you could say that there's a risk that what if a user finds the error before your test does? But then if you have a safety net in place and maybe use that as part of your canary deployments, or, you know, some kind of progressive deployment strategy, that goes a long way. I think no testing strategy is perfect. So I think it's something that we see people playing with today to kind of be able to facilitate, like you said, productivity, to make sure that the inner development loops and the deployment is not hampered by too much testing. So you're just still unit tests, yes, because they're part of the build. Maybe some critical component testing in the middle, but the high level end-to-end integration testing is something you do more at the end of just before things are on their way into the production environment.
Yeah, and ideally this is fast, right? I mean, you can absolutely deploy multiple times a day, and figure out like how ready your actual build is, or your actual feature is, in this way. I mean, it kind of everything converges in this view a little bit. In this stage, just while you're talking, I'm seeing this picture of basically having this playwright tests or some API tests as a zero stage canary, right?
Mm-hmm.
So before you are letting any like actual users test it, you are running this kind of artificial workload, synthetic workload against it. And then once that passes, you are taking then the next steps. But you're already in production. You're losing actual dependencies. You may have some clever things to kind of redirect some traffic on that stage, but essentially it could be just the production deployment. And then also with the load tests, right? I think a lot of this or some of the test specification you would do with a playwright or maybe also with a like SOAP UI or Postman tool are very similar to the load test scenarios which you are defining. And so there's also a question, can you just leverage this information about critical workflows for your like testing in that way, so that you are using that to validate that the logic is actually working. And then the other thing where it dovetails is, as you said, continuous testing and monitoring and SLOs and so on. So just some of our synthetic probe SLOs that I've seen are pretty much end-to-end user tests that are simulated, and then some horrific things happens to make a number out of it.
I mean, load testing is something that we see a lot of people adopting, specifically K6. I think the ops team is running that. That could be. I mean, load testing itself is a vast field. I think we like to recommend. So if you're not doing like the in production testing, is to make sure you're running load tests in parallel with other types of tests, just to kind of see the effect load has on functionality or security. It's easy to orchestrate in most tools. But I think another just interesting, backing up a little, is around testing and culture. And I think, I was just on a call earlier today where I made the mistake of asking about, you know, how does the QA team does this, or how does the, and they're like, we don't have a QA team. It's all one team now, and we're shifting left. And, I think shift left has been, has been a thing for a long time. And I think a lot of organizations are trying to, move testing to be earlier in the development life cycle. I still think that the challenge with that is that it often ends up being maybe more unit tests, and that because the individual teams often own like a component, like let's say a microservice or etc. So unless you're a small startup, you don't own the big application, so you feel like I'm the one responsible for, you know, this piece, this service, this component, and I have some unit tests and I have some API tests, and I'll make sure that they get run, you know, depending on the pipelines. But then that integration test, that big thing that makes sure that all the things work together, who's that on, right? Because it's not really, is it the front end team that's building the web app or the, you know, the front end? Is it on them to make sure, because they're going to say, well, it's not that we can create tests that test just the front end. We'll knock out the back end, so we can make sure that our, you know, UI reacts in the correct way to this, you know, errors and whatever it might come from the back end. But it's not really up to them to write tests that validate that the back end is providing the correct data. And I guess I think that's an interesting area where I sometimes see people kind of falls between chairs. I don't know if you say that in English. You say it's a Swedish expression. So it's like, who owns that overall? So I think, as much as I think shifting left is good, and I think doing quality earlier is good, it's not it does leave some maybe holes in the testing and quality process. Maybe not, once again, if you're a small startup for 3 or 4 engineers, maybe that's not an issue. But if it's a big team, I don't know. Does that resonate with you, that reasoning?
Yeah, 100%, 100%. It's really tricky because, like, if you think about this large companies where you have like a site which is supported by hundreds of teams, then everybody is just owning a small bit of it. And then you have this layer cake where like all the kind of layers have to work together. But in the org structure, you maybe have a single person, which is the CEO or CTO, which is actually accountable for the whole thing. And everybody else is underfunded, and they will be very clear on where their accountability ends, and there is like very little incentive to kind of like ensure beyond the boundaries. Mm-hmm. And the space beyond the boundaries gets larger and larger. Mm-hmm. And I think it's critical to as an organization to figure out how to like fill the gaps and to produce end user value at the end. Mm-hmm. But this is actually legitimately hard. Mm-hmm. And also with like just having a central QA team to own that, mm-hmm. it's also very challenging because they identified bugs or problems and like what to do now. So they just file a bug and that's it. Mm. And then it just goes to the queue. Do they halt releases? Are you still doing a release train or do you continuous deployment? So it's already out there. Mm. And then you basically need a project manager downstream of the QA team who runs after teams to fix it. You have to battle with priorities. How important is that bug and so on? And you have a couple of people. I mean, you can probably survive in those roles, but those do not tend to be the most rewarding roles.
No, that's a good point. Definitely, like many things that are like painful, something you need to maybe figure out before they happen or try to tackle head on and understand the challenges. I think it's super interesting. I'd love to talk to organizations, you know, that have this problem and see how they've solved that, and maybe it's a lot about culture, right? Just being transparent and open and working together versus having, you know, the QA team is over there, we're over here, and Jira is our interface. So it's there needs to be something different. And I guess it's like many things, it's an overall culture process thing. So if as long as everyone understands or kind of those constraints and the playground, I think that's maybe not as big of a problem. I think the problem maybe more arises that if people don't understand the dependencies and like we were saying, the gaps that arise in those, and then it's like, oh, it's not me, it's you. And then, so anyway, so it's an interesting challenge. And I think building software is hard, and as we know, and we move around the problems versus the complexity moves around, and we'll always finding ways to kind of solve. But that also makes it exciting.
Yeah,
to be in.
I mean, in the reliability space, one of the core learnings for me is that it's a socio-technical system, right? It's people and it's technology. Mm. And it's a lot about how those two factors play together in order to achieve reliability. Mm-hmm. And it's all about feedback loops and how to engineer those feedback loops and how to make the feedback loop small. I think we already touched on this with the dev loop, right? So, and for this, I mean, it's in essence, it's a reliability topic, or even though it may be just more manifest as a bug, not as an incident. But here it's also, it's about a feedback loop you establish. You may have a process for this involving a QA team that kind of feeds a socio-technical system. The smaller you can make the loop, the better. I mean, if you have an organization which is strictly vertically cut, mm-hmm. you always have a single stakeholder responsible end-to-end for the part of the functionality. So that feedback loop can happen within that thing. You may not have a platform. Everybody is on AWS, figures it out themselves. Mm-hmm. But the moment you have the horizontal layers in it, either on the front-end side or on lower layers, and they all have to coordinate, and you get like organizational boundaries. And you have to draw those boundaries somewhere if you want to divide and conquer. Mm-hmm. So suddenly you have a feedback loop which involves stakeholders from like the big parts of the organization, and then you have this additional friction which is introduced. So I think it's very specific to the organization, but I think fundamentally the tools to reason about it and to address this in these organizations are this kind of high level process engineering things. And I'm acutely aware that I have to read up on a couple of things there. Google dropped the paper the other week. I have like the handbooks from the 90s printed out read up on this.
There's a lot to read up on always.
Yeah. Like, let's see if there's some solutions. Mm-hmm. certainly, I think, promising approaches and recognition of the right setting. Mm. But it's also sometimes get too far away from technology, then it becomes also very hand wavy and not so actionable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'd like to get your opinion on one thing. So one interesting that observation. So if you look at the CNCF landscape, there's almost nothing related to testing, right? So there's K6, I think. There's TestCube. There is, I don't know, maybe some other vendors, but that have kind of, you know, that are legacy vendors that have kind of put their flag on that landscape. But there's very little or almost no tooling that's kind of in the CNCF ecosystem that's kind of focused on testing. I'm trying to kind of think of why is that? But people care about testing. One is maybe you think that testing is more a CI/CD thing, so that it's kind of rolled into the delivery pipeline. I don't remember what the category was on the landscape. Or maybe it's just testing is late to the game and we'll see more things coming in there. We're obviously with TestCube, we're saying, hey, look, we're the only ones, but we're not, there are others. But I don't know, what do you think? Do you feel like there's a testing is just not top of mind yet? Is it too early? And is it something that'll, you know, maybe come in later as a sign of maturity? I don't mean that in a bad way.
It's a very interesting question. And I don't want to go too far outside of my domain of expertise, but I think there, like CNCF, why are you joining the CNCF as a project or what benefits do you have? And there are certainly like governance and licensing things which are important. Also, like if you are investing as a single company, you want to have kind of a neutral governance body. So there is some gravity by projects are ending up in that domain, which is like creating like the need for projects to be owned by a foundation like that. I think Apache Software Foundation is somewhat similar in some sense. So and from that perspective, I'm not sure if there's so much of a need for those testing tools to be like part of that foundation. And the other thing is just culturally, I think there is really a maturity thing happening since deploying things to production, operating things in production, those are kind of the first steps. And for a long time, I think people were pretty happy with the CI, like the unit testing frameworks, and it wasn't really clear what cloud native testing would be. At least in the people I talk to, this testing and production topic is fairly recent. And I have myself just basically put my hand into the air for a long time and just said, like, I have no idea what a good, like, strategic high-level target picture would look like.
Good points. Good points you made there. I think maybe it is just a reflection on what we were talking about, that testing in cloud native is something that's somewhat spread out, right? But just by the nature of what cloud native works. So it is something that is, I'm sure all of these things, many tools have kind of support for testing in one way or another. Of course, they do testing in some one way or another. So maybe it's a reflection that it's more kind of something that's like an aspect of tools versus having needing its own category. Also, like you said, maybe they don't need to be there. And also, it feels like the landscape is getting so big now that it's easy to drown, or it's easy to start not to drown, but it's hard to be noticed. Sorry, that's what I was saying. So you'll just or to stand out in that landscape.
Yeah.
There's so many tools now for, you know, each category, which also maybe somewhat dilutes the landscape in itself, but that's my personal opinion. Not sure everyone agrees with that. But
yeah, I don't know. But this conversation reminds me of another very fascinating aspect of your career that we maybe can talk about now a little bit.
Okay.
Which is CubeShop. You are not only a CTO of TestCube, you launched like at least a handful of projects in the Kubernetes space.
Yes.
And you did that in a very interesting way, basically just like an incubator, working with different teams together with one or two investors, I don't know.
Yeah, but so KubeShop, it's like a, I think technically you could call it a studio, like, you know, like game studios. So the idea was to basically bootstrap or acquire open source projects that target cloud native in any way, and then build a team around those and try to, you know, make sure they have traction and users, et cetera, and then try to build a commercial offering on top of that. So similar to what we did with Sopura and Swagger and others at SmartBear. So I think that was kind of the idea. So we started 3.5 years ago now. We kicked off with 3 projects, Monocle, TestCube, and Cusk. Then we onboarded 3 more projects during the time, which CubeFirst, which was acquired by Sivo, which is now called Construct, I think they renamed it. It's like a GitOps provisioning platform. Mm-hmm. TraceTest, which was a trace-based testing based on OpenTelemetry traces, and BotCube, which was an open source monitoring solution. So of those first 3, Monocle, which was like a Kubernetes YAML manifest IDE, we've shelved that project, so we weren't able to make any commercials. It's actually still pretty popular. We still get like feature requests and bug reports, so it's still out there on GitHub. So all of these projects are still out there, but TestCube is the one that's gone kind of done best, and that's where we're doubling down now going forward. And that's super exciting. It's always exciting to build new stuff and to see them take off and to see them find, you know, customers and usage and all that.
It looks absolutely fascinating. It's kind of like a hack, right? So when I think about like founding a company and stuff like this, I always think super high risk, right? I have one shot and I have to be fully invested and I have to kind of make that work. Mm-hmm. And this, like, you were able to kind of invest into 6 different ideas and just try them out. Can you like explain this concept a little better and what were kind of the situation why you were able to kind of operate like this?
Yeah. Well, we had investors from day one, so we that were willing to fund. They wanted to get into the space of open source Kubernetes cloud native, and we'd worked with them before, so they trusted us to be able to do this. And then, like you said, we had ideas. We built teams around each of those ideas. We basically hired a product or a CEO or a product like lead, and then engineer, and in a small engineering team. We also got DevRel on board very early. And then we kind of tried to nurture those projects. So to be honest, in Aftersight, having 6 projects was not maybe a good idea. It was too many. At least I like to get my fingers dirty. So it was, I think 3 would have been enough, and by far, right? It depends on kind of how experienced teams you hire. If they've done this before, they can run with it, and you only need to give them high level guidance, then it works. But if they're maybe not seasoned or haven't built like a company before, they need much more hands on guidance. Maybe not on the technical side, but more on the go to market, you know, finding product market fit, business value, that kind of stuff. So I think that's one learning that if I do it again in that kind of setup, make sure that you really have capable teams in place and leaders for each of those teams.
Yeah.
And I think the other big learning to share maybe is that even if you want to do this open source first motion, it's important to have a very clear idea of how you're going to monetize and commercialize that open source from the beginning, even if you're not implementing it. So I think we made the mistake of saying, we'll figure it out. And while we did for TestCube, we didn't for some of the others, right? Yeah. So because you're at the risk of, you know, maybe building too much too good of a product, right? Giving away too much value, or not focusing on the right. So if you know from advance that this is how we're going to commercialize this, this is the extra value or whatever model you're going to have, that really helps you also, you know, target and build the right product, the open source product from the beginning. So there's nothing wrong with starting with open source, but I just think you need to make sure you understand where you're going with it if the goal is to build commercial on top of it.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And maybe we can now talk a little about TestCube as a company and as a tool, and then look at the business model here as well from this perspective, right? Because it has this open source part, and I think the UI basically is the commercial aspect of it, the SaaS behind it.
Yeah, so TestCube is a test execution framework for Kubernetes. It takes any test that you might already have, any kind of, you know, end-to-end test, API test, whatever, load test, and runs those tests inside your Kubernetes cluster. So it leverages Kubernetes infrastructure to, or mechanics to scale and, you know, do all the things you might want to do if you're running a lot of tests at scale. And then it integrates with your CI/CD and with all, you know, how, I think this is one else aspect we talked about earlier. Triggering of tests is not strictly tied to CI/CD, but also could be triggered based on cron like schedules, or it could be based on events inside your Kubernetes cluster. It could be based on webhooks coming, you know, incoming requests coming from, you know, cargo or, you know, whatever other system you might have. So this flexibility of running test execution whenever you might need it versus having it tightly coupled to CI/CD is like a big selling point. And then the fact that we run all the tests is that we can do nice reporting and results. And we also have some AI features now to help you understand logs and things like that. So that's kind of the high level.
Hooking in there directly. What one thing I learned from our earlier conversations was that I think that the target picture is pretty much this cloud native testing that we talked before, like where you already deploy into a staging cluster, right?
Yes.
And then TestCube is kind of the thing that exercises and actuates all the things in your cluster to kind of validate that kind of deployment is in the state that it should be. So exactly. Is that kind of this is the main way which intended to be used?
Yeah. Yes. So so it's not a testing tool per se. So whatever tests you've written today with Playwright or Postman or, you know, JMeter or whatever, it'll take those tests and then it'll run those and orchestrate the execution of those tests inside your clusters. So just like you said, our users, either they have a fixed testing a cluster or namespace or environment where they deploy and then they run tests using TestCube, or they do ephemeral environments, you know, using whatever approach, and then use TestCube to run those tests. And then TestCube will then aggregate all the results and logs and everything in the dashboard where you can then troubleshoot those tests, no matter how they were triggered and what testing tool they were and so on. So it's that kind of test agnostic aspect. But it's an agent that you run inside your cluster that spawns the actual job and pods that runs the test. So it's a test orchestration framework. And then that's the agent is open source. People can use that. No strings attached. It's on GitHub. And then there's a control plane which has a nice dashboard and which helps you manage the agents or multiple agents. So let's say I have, you know, 10, 20, 15 agents running in different environments from the control plane. It connects to all of those, you know, aggregates all the results and then provides RBAC and reporting and, you know, a bunch of features that appeal to, you know, teams, versus just doing, standalone instances of the agent. So that's kind of the model.
Yeah.
And that's what we charge for. And we see that most our customers are on-prem customers. So they prefer to run this control plane in their own environment. We do also have a cloud version, but that's most people like to keep their test execution data in their infrastructure because logs can contain, you know, debug statements from that might contain things you don't want. You just want to make sure it's in your control.
So basically, running the tests, configuring the tests, all that can be done with the open source tool. You kind of have to, or you do that, like either from the command line or the configuration of the tests, like the code or configuration. And then the analysis, the triggering of the tests via UI, that is the part where a commercial offering comes in.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. To your point, the agent, you can install the agent and the open source agent and interact with the CLI. All the tests, the executions are defined as CRDs. So it's very kind of Kubernetes native. We have a lot of users using Argo and like a GitOps approach to kind of manage those resources. You can run through CLI, you can trigger the execution of tests, you can retrieve the logs and the artifacts and all that kind of stuff through the CLI or API. And then the dashboard just, or the control plane just makes all that much easier. And then it adds a layer of security. So who can run what tests where, right? Mm. It provides more of a reporting dashboard. If you want to have graphs, you know, what is it? Show me all the test executions for tests, playwright tests with this label that ran over this date and pass fail ratios, you know, you know, the kind of quality reporting that you might want to do to evaluate your, the quality status of your applications and a bunch of other features. I think what's maybe worth to note is that we've really built the underlying engine very attuned to how testing tools work. So one common need is to parallelize test execution. So both for load tests like K6 or JMeter or Gatling or Artillery, or functional tests like Playwright, Cypress, Selenium, you might want to parallelize those tests, right? To either simulate, you know, run against multiple browsers or just cut down on overall execution time. So we've built an engine that really is very aligned to how testing tools do that, and then can leverage the Kubernetes to do that, to you know, spin up all those pods and pull in all the logs and distribute and configurations, et cetera, et cetera. So while you could surely script these things if you wanted, you know, using GitHub Actions or using a generic workflow engine, it's going to be a lot more work because you can use those to do a bunch of things that TestCube can't do.
Yeah, I think there's also not just that it's like more work, but it also opens this kind of features up to different user groups. It's not just developers who were able to use TestCube. It's also like QA testers, if you like, or product managers who could take a look at this data with that kind of UI.
And it provides them with that single pane of glass, right? Where the product manager can go in and look at, if they're technical, look at the results from tests for their application, no matter how those tests were triggered from a canary, you know, progressive deployment, or if they were triggered manually, if they were triggered from a Kubernetes event or from a CI/CD pipeline, it all goes into the same place. And it so they don't have to go to the GitLab dashboard to look at something, or don't have to go over there to find that. It's all nicely aggregated in place. And so that's TestCube is a product that really works well in large, you know, setups in teams that have multiple pipelines, CI/CD tools, multiple testing tools, both old and new. So if you're a small team just running K6 or Postman tests, maybe the open source version is just fine, or just, you know, just GitHub Actions to start with. It really hits home when it's a very complex environment where people have tests running all over the place and then they don't really have a good one place to go to kind of consolidate like troubleshooting and reporting and just test execution management.
Yeah. How do you think about integrations on the UI side with like standard company tools? There's this Backstage tool that I think a lot of companies are like using, or this general like developer portal movement. And I guess there's like probably more, certainly on the observability side, you would expect to integrate with Grafana. That doesn't really make sense, but there's certainly the integration with the CI/CD systems on the other side, right?
Well, definitely CI/CD. Yeah. So I think that's kind of still the main way people trigger tests execution. So that's a cornerstone for us to make sure that works. Prometheus, Grafana, also very common. And so, for example, the open source agent exposes Prometheus metrics, right? So you could build your own dashboard just to kind of get high level metrics. The others, you mentioned Backstage. That's something also we hear a lot. So being able to maybe embed like test execution results for my service in the developer portal is something that we've we're looking at, and we're just, we have some customers using Backstage. The challenge is that they all want different things. So everyone uses Backstage a little bit differently, and maybe for serving different purposes. So we'll have to kind of figure out where do we start, and what do we expose, and where do we draw the line when they actually have to go to the test cube dashboard. But we have, of course, you know, understand that it would be valuable to expose some of that data too. But there's an API, a REST API, which, you know, going back to Swagger, we have a, there's an open API definition, and there's all of that stuff. So it's fairly straightforward to kind of pull data from that API if someone is wants to just surface some basic stuff in any application that they're building. But integration is super important. I think any tool today needs to play in an ecosystem of tools, right? So you're never coming into a company where there's nothing. So it's both about CI/CD, like you were saying. It's about integrating, may often like test management, issue management, incident management, like PagerDuty or Jira, Grafana, or maybe reporting tools like Allure. There's just a lot out there that we need to make sure that we can play with. So we have webhooks support, and we have an API and all that kind of stuff. I think we technically we can integrate with most things, but I think now we need to add like a usability layer to that, right? So it's, you're not required to craft your own webhook to integrate with Slack. It should be more of an easier way to do that. And that's kind of the questions we're getting. It's more, sometimes more non-technical users who want to, okay, how do I connect this to Microsoft Teams? Well, you can create a webhook and we'll help you craft the YAML. And they're like, I don't know about that. It's not always like a seasoned DevOps person that's on there. So that's, I think when we get into big enterprises, you also need to make sure that you kind of make a product easy to adopt and to integrate and not require like low-level technical knowledge.
Yeah, I come to this topic since you mentioned this single pane of glass word, and it's like if you acquire a lot of tools, you have a lot of single pane of glass, and they are like all for their own domains, which are like either overlapping or not so much overlapping. But you have the real challenge that there is just, it's so many tools and the adoption will really struggle. You have to do a lot of education to just make people aware that this is available and just the value you provide to a large population by just making things available is pretty low. So you have to actually make them use it. And making a lot of developer using things is also like, that's not easy. And the key question that like in a platform team, I always ask is like, how do you hook into the existing user journeys? So what do your developers right now do in order to achieve a certain goal and where can we kind of hook in? And this is like where I see the developer portals to take like a absolutely like central role. This will be the starting point for everything. Everything kind of has to start in the developer portal. And then, of course, you can branch out, but your user journeys are always going through it. Then they maybe go to the CI/CD system, and then maybe from there they go to your test system. But kind of having like entities like applications tracked, and then all the like, here's the test for them, here's the API docs for them, here are the CI/CD pipelines, here are the Git repositories. Just like as a member of an enterprise, I would be always really keen on getting this stuff in place. And the better vendors are integrating with that kind of environment, the more value we will get out of it relatively quickly.
No, it makes total sense. I think from to your point, right, you want to have one single pane of glass for where your developers can go, and this is the service I'm working on, and from there they can go, here's my pipelines, here are my tests, here are my code repository, here's my that, versus having to go the other way around. So I totally understand that that makes a lot of sense, I think, and it's a great story, right? And it really, I think, facilitates very, you know, reasonably productive workflows for the developers. So it's obviously something we should be, you know, aware of. And I think that's an interesting, I mean, developer portals and Backstage specifically have had a lot of traction or like interest, right? If you look at the preview, there's even BackstageCom now, right? So, so there's definitely their need for that kind of tooling as tools like TestCube and others provide their own dashboards and single panes of glasses where you can kind of aggregate that. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So it's, I'll just have to bump it up in the back in the roadmap.
I mean,
always constrained by people. I'd love to do it. I think it would be super cool if you could say, hey, yeah, sure, we have a Backstage plugin, you know, just connect it here, and then you can start visualizing test results. I think we just need to figure, we need to find a good use case and a customer we can work with, maybe, to make sure we're not, you know, it's not a blind shot, but it's, we'd like to make sure that what we're building is at least super helpful for someone. And then we can go from there, versus doing something that we think is helpful and then it's not a perfect fit.
I mean, you are the serial CTO. So I learned from you on how to evolve the feature set.
I know.
Yeah. No, it's, but the funnel, I mean, imagine this is really developer driven. So people are finding the open source project, they are playing around with it, they kind of start using it in their teams, and then some time later in the process, the organization gets kind of involved. Is that like how the cycle usually works?
Yeah, I think it's like, I'm not sure the, so that's definitely one important on-ramp to the product. So, but we also see a fair amount of people going straight to trialing the commercial product. So definitely there are people who are open source first. They want to kick the tires. There's no strings attached. And they start with the open source version, and then they use that for, you know, 6-12 months. And then at some point, there's a tipping point where actually it would be nice to have dashboard and all the additional features that provides our organization. But equally often we get people just saying, hey, read about TestCube, saw a demo, looks great, can you show it to our team, we'd like to do a proof of concept. And I think maybe many of the organizations, the type of organization we're targeting, are maybe more used to buying software that way, or at least not a stranger to buying that software that way. We see both of those onboarding paths. So I felt like, is that really a viable path? Don't you have to start with open source and kind of seed things and get people to try it, and then you build on that? But I was wrong there. There's definitely a way to launch new software just with a trial commercial motion. If it provides value and you're good at communicating that, people will, you know, usually give it a try.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Basically, like how to play certain things, like open sourcing versus non-open sourcing technology, right? Because also, like, open sourcing, it's so hard to sustain a business when you are giving away, like, as you said, like most of the value for free. You want this to be there, you want to contribute, but at the same time you need to eat, you need to like figure out how to monetize enough to at least pay a handful of developers to kind of actively develop it forward. And then it's like the much more natural pathway is just through commercial software which you sell. But specifically in the monitoring space, like the open source one in many regards, like first of all Prometheus, that just like conquered everything, and in retrospect, or also like open source databases, which were more successful. And there's always like a thought, like, would you like open source a product to just increase adoption, that you are like getting so much adoption that you can survive on kind of the margin business that you do by providing the kind of services, like managed services or a nicer UI or whatever. And it's those calls are incredibly hard to make, specifically if you have already customers, because you would be like devaluing your existing like revenue streams significantly. Looks like recently you have really embraced this open source first and then building value on top as a way to do it.
I think struck me on all of these, actually, starting with SOAP UI, is that the open source community is rarely, they don't mind that there's a commercial offering. There was always a fear that, oh, now you're just going to, you know, try to make money off us. But most people get, okay, you need to, it's a sign of maturity. You need to your point, pay the bills. The fact that there's a commercial company behind it makes it much more safe to adopt, because there's an interest in it. So I wouldn't, maybe it's an obvious thing for others, but I think there's nothing to be ashamed of or afraid of commercializing an open source project. Just finding the balance may be hard, to your point, and how much do you give away and how much do you not give away. And you can also, as long as you have stories to tell, I think you can evolve that, you know, that line, or walk that line pretty aggressively as you move forward. So I think I would definitely encourage people to try that model, but maybe with the caveats that we talked about before. Yeah. Have a clear view initially of this is the value we're going to commercialize, and then don't give away that value just because you're eager to get users, because that'll make it harder for you further down.
So just speaking very high level, what do you see as the most promising like business models for a like commercial entity tied to an open source? Like broadly speaking, I think Red Hat was the first super successful one, which had this basically enterprise support model, which I don't think it turned out to be that replicatable. And then there is this kind of, you just said, a pro version, which has the enterprise integration and the Octas and something like this. And there is always then the question, like, how many features are you kind of holding back and you're discouraging the community to build? And it looks like the SaaS add-ons have like a better stance. But yeah, am I missing broadly, or what other models do you see, and like how do you reason about this on a high level?
Oh, it's a great question. So like you said, like dual licensing is also something you see. I don't know if that kind of like MySQL did it initially, and others. I don't know. It's hard to say one's better than the other. Maybe it goes. I don't really have a good answer. Sorry,
okay.
It's just hard.
Yeah,
I think one thing to maybe also be aware of, that building an open source community takes time, and unless you're Kelsey Hightower or someone that, you know, you have really, really strong brand, or you know someone that can help you really promote it to a large audience, where you know that you'll immediately get high uptake just because of that. But if you're, you know, starting it'll take a long time, years. And I think, that's at least something to be aware of. And it's also, I think, hard to kind of force once again, and at least, sure, you can do marketing campaigns but ultimately it takes time for people to adopt the product and to replace their existing solution, what they have, which might be working reasonably well, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not saying it can't be done in a short time, but I would, if I embark on this journey again, once, say, this is going to take building an open source community, which I can then commercialize, I would say, you know, at least 2-3 years to get somewhere meaningful. Or I wouldn't. That's kind of the expectation I would set. Then, if I'm faster, good for me. But that's kind of my experience. So maybe others are much better at this, and they'll succeed faster. It depends, of course. You know, if you're in the right space at the right time, you know, then it can go faster. But in general,
I think it's incredibly hard, because the technology really has to speak for itself. With companies, you can just like sometimes do marketing or play like certain, just be at the right place. But with open source tech, I think you need to be a great technologist and really understand deeply what's missing to be successful there. Yeah.
And there's so much out there. There's so much noise. So
yeah,
fighting for that, you know, attention. Hey, look, I have another better solution to this problem, and trying to get. Yeah, I don't know. It's just speaking from experience, it can be frustrating. But on the other hand, once you get that ball rolling, and it's been rolling for a year or two, then you're a year or two ahead of other projects getting started, right? So
yeah,
don't underestimate what the kind of the brand awareness that you've built, and continue building on that.
Yeah. So the Test Cube open source community is healthy and strong.
Well, we do have a healthy user base of open source. We don't have a lot of people. We get some bug reports, you know, interactions on Slack and how do I do this, which is super valuable for us. Yeah. We don't have any people contributing code, at this point. I mean, guess maybe that's one of the, maybe that's like a, how did that could be a challenge. Like, how do you get people to contribute code to something that also goes into a commercial product? I can understand that maybe not everyone is inclined to do that. But it's, that's okay. I mean, we do get some contributions, but like I said, bug fixes, bug reports, etc., but not like major.
But it looks like at the moment, you're also not proactively like seeking for contributors to the open source version.
No, fair enough. Fair enough. We're doubling down on the commercial version right now to kind of try to build the company around it. But it's definitely open source is important for us. And it's something we want to continue kind of supporting and like promoting and probably maybe doing it more in the future. I think last year was very much focused on getting the commercial motion going. And, you know, getting those initial customers in and, you know, getting all that process running. And I think now that we've achieved that, I think I'd love to kind of maybe show some more love for the open source aspects of TestCube.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely resonates. Just like deploying proprietary software as an executable to an internal cluster, it always feels like very odd.
Sure.
And there were certainly, like also in the monitoring domain, like certain components where I was like, just give me the damn code so I can understand why the CPU is pegged at like 85% and I can do some magic to re-alleviate my pain or just understand what you were actually executing and why my test is not running and so on. So just having source available is already already a big point.
No, that definitely makes sense. And we want to, like I said, a lot of people do want to kick the tires of software, something that they're considering to install. I mean, especially at a company like yours, it's you know, you really want to make sure that what you're getting in there is something that is reliable and you know, works as you need it to.
Yeah, you would hope.
Okay.
So what's up like next for you? Any conferences planned? Any like big announcements?
Well, the big KubeCon we started this thing called Cube Jam in Paris last year. So I'll take the opportunity and make some noise about that. So if you're an aspiring amateur musician, what we're doing is we basically rent a bunch of instruments, get people together and jam together. It was amazing in Paris, because we really had no idea of how this was going to play out. We had no plan. It was just, let's see what happens. Okay. And there was even staff from the event venue who joined in. So that was great. And there are videos on YouTube. And then we did it again in Salt Lake City. It was a little bit more organized and we're going to do that again in London. So, if people want to come and play, that'd be awesome. So that's the big thing ahead of us right now.
Nice. So
how about for you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, like the next thing that I haven't publicly talked about it, but it's not a secret. I will be program chair at SREcon EMEA in October.
Okay.
And so that's like where, like, it's probably the most exciting thing for me coming up this year. And trying to figure out what we are going to do with the program.
Nice. Oh, that's great. Congrats. That's exciting. And on the private note, I saw you did your first marathon last year.
Yeah, that's true.
Congratulations. How was that?
Amazing. I mean, the bigger story, and I also talked publicly about this quite a bit, was really for me fixing some health problems around mental health, getting away from burnout and becoming a lot more grounded and fit. And it feels so much better. And also project like this podcast, I wouldn't have been able to do it like a year before, just because I would not be able to manage like so many balls in the air and feel a lot more grounded, a lot fitter. And then you can do a lot more. And you are not stressing out about it.
That's so great. That's awesome. Are you planning to do one this year as well?
Yeah, planning to do the Hermannslauf, which is a 30K in April. And then I will do a marathon this year. Not 100% decided. Some of the like you have to register for it, and it's not so clear if you get the spots. But my fallback is in Oldenburg. There's a night run, which I did last year. It's a very, very small event. But
That's nice.
I will go back to that.
It's Oldenburg is a nice city. I've been there. Nice. Cool.
Okay, Ole. Cool.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. This has been a blast. Very, very interesting. And thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. A pleasure to talk to you, Heinrich, to do it again.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.